Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. Well, first of all, I want to thank the organizers very much for giving me the opportunity to come here. And I already had several really good discussions here. I've been asked to give an overview talk. So basically, instead of going into too much detail, rather focusing on some methods that we apply to one problem and then show how it applies to another problem. At least that's the approach I took here. So what I'm going to do is, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get through all of it, but I'm going to try to give you an overview over three different problems that we've looked at. And the first one actually started way back with my thesis advisor, Jim Sethna, and then all these collaborators. And what I want to do is basically just give you the gist of the problem and then show you some new results that we got. But what I want to focus on is some methods that we've learned from this problem, and then we transferred these methods to the next problem on earthquakes. That's work with Daniel Fisher and Yehuda Ben Zion and collaborators, and I want to show you how you can basically what you learn in a problem that has to do with magnets and systems with avalanches, how you can transfer some of the ideas and the methods to something that offhand looks completely different. And then I want to especially emphasize the work of my students, John Carpenter, Robert White, and Amit Mehta, and they all want to graduate this May, so they'll be on the job market pretty soon. So I'll try to put some of that in, but in this overview talk, I won't be able to go into too much detail on any of these. And then finally, if I have some time left, I want to just say a few words about connections to population biology, and that's actually work with Nadav Schnerb, and in next week he's going to tell you a lot more, I'm sure, about that, and he's here anyway, so he can give you the details on that. Okay. Now, just as an introduction, because I don't know exactly which areas of study everybody here comes from, what we look at is systems with hysteresis. Now, hysteresis comes up in a lot of different systems. You know, when you bend copper, say a rod of copper, out of shape and you bend it back, then you have hysteresis in your system. And in fact, there you have something that's called work hardening. So every time you go through the cycle, it gets harder. Now, that's not the kind of hysteresis we've been looking at, but we've been looking at hysteresis where every time you go around the loop, you have to exert the exact same field, you have the same condition, so you can go through this hysteresis loop many times and always looks the same, it doesn't change. So this is hysteresis without any effects of work hardening. And then we've been focusing also on systems where your hysteretic response is not smooth. I mean, in this copper rod, you have a rather smooth response. But if you look, say, at hysteresis in magnets, as you apply a field, you get an avalanche type of response. So you have this jerky response where each of these jumps here corresponds to a little avalanche. In this case, an avalanche of redirection of magnetic moments, or you could say in martensites, those are the shape memory alloys, when you pull on them or you bend them out of shape, they crackle. So there you have also these little jumps that correspond to avalanches. And magnets turn out to be a very nice experimental system to study hysteretic systems with avalanches. Typically, people measure these avalanches with a Barkhausen noise. So you take your magnetic material and you put it in, wrap a search coil around it, and then you hook it up to a loudspeaker, and you hear some crackling noise. And this crackling noise basically tells you how big the domains were that were reoriented due to these induction pulses. So in magnets you can measure this Barkhausen noise, in martensites you measure acoustic emission to get an idea about the size of these avalanches. Now, there are lots of systems with avalanches. I mean, I've just told you about two, but there are lots of them. So superconductors, for example, so I talked about these first two here, magnets and martensites, but in superconductors, you can have avalanches of vortices moving. And there are very nice experiments by Bob Halleck and collaborators on liquid helium invading nuclear pores. So say if you have, they take a porous material and they pump in helium, liquid helium, into this filter-like material, and then they pump the helium out, and they find that they get up to 10 to the 7 pores emptying in one avalanche. So that's another system. Or rupture in fibrous materials. You know, if you break this, it definitely crackles. So there you have avalanches of fiber breakings. And then finally, earthquakes. That's what I'll look at in a little bit. You can think of earthquakes also as systems with avalanches where you have one region rupturing and then triggering other regions to rupture as well. And what all these systems have in common is that you have, if you look at a histogram of the avalanche sizes in these systems, you get a very broad distribution of avalanche sizes. So not just a Gaussian, like in these earthquakes, you know that, right? There's this famous Gutenberg-Richter law, where if you look at a histogram of earthquakes around the whole Earth, you get a power law distribution over a very broad range, and then with some cutoff. And the question is, why do you get these broad ranges of avalanche sizes in all these different systems? And there have been, in some of these systems, there have been suggestions, well, maybe the system is what is called self-organized critical. So what this means is that somehow your system self-organizes to look the same on all length scales. And then if it looks the same on all length scales, then if you drive it, it can also only produce avalanches in response to your driving field of all sizes. So then they say, well, maybe this power law distribution of avalanche sizes is the reflection of this self-organized criticality. What this means really is that there is no tuning parameter. It would mean that no matter what kind of parameters in your system you choose, you would always get the power law, and it would always extend all the way to the system size. Now, we've taken a different approach. We've asked, well, we know that near phase transitions you get power law scaling. So the question is, could there be an underlying phase transition leading to these power law distributions of avalanches?
Well,
yep.
Both assume a phase transition. The tuning is the self-organized part.
Right.
In both points of view, you have criticality.
True.
The question is it criticality with a tuning parameter or without?
That's exactly what I mean. That's exactly what I mean. So basically the question is there a tuning parameter that has to be at a certain special critical point in order to see this or not? That's exactly right. Okay, so now if there is such a tuning parameter, the next question is, what is it? And for that, just to give you a feel for what's going on, here's an experiment. And by now, actually, he has done by Andreas Berger, who is now with Hitachi, and he has recently done a very careful job in a completely different system. But I thought it was too involved to explain that there was a multi-layer system there. I'll stick to this one to make a point. He took thin gadolinium films. And he measured the hysteresis loop as a function of field. And at first, he found a very smooth hysteresis loop. And then he subsequently annealed this sample at higher and higher annealing temperatures. And what he found was that annealing the sample basically gave him a better and better crystal structure. And for each of these samples, he measured the hysteresis loop. So basically, what you see here is a sequence of hysteresis loops in purer and purer systems. So down here, this is a very pure system. You see you have a hysteresis loop with a jump, while up here you have a smooth hysteresis loop with no jump. And basically what we're asking is whether between these two regimes there is a critical amount of disorder where the size of this jump here has just shrunk to zero, and you have a critical hysteresis loop where your magnetization curve curves in here with a power law. And then if this is really a phase transition, then you would expect this power law to be universal. That means it would be independent of the microscopic details of your system. It would be the same for a whole bunch of different materials. And then you could, if this is true, you could write down a phase diagram. So on one axis you would have the disorder, on the other axis you would have magnetic field. And so basically if you sweep your field at low disorder, you eventually have a jump in your loop, that would be this jump, while if you sweep your field at high disorder, you get a smooth loop, and in between these two regimes, there's this second order phase transition point at a critical disorder where you expect to see power law scaling. So basically, for this critical loop, for example, if you do a histogram of your avalanche sizes, you would expect to see a power law distribution, and then as you tune away from this critical point, you would expect to see a change in the cutoff of this distribution of avalanche sizes. So that would correspond to a change in the correlation length. So here the correlation length is your system size, and then as you say go to higher disorder, your correlation length shrinks, and that is reflected by a smaller cutoff in your avalanche size distribution. But unfortunately, for none of these loops, they could measure actually the Barkhausen noise. So this is from a completely different experiment, and they found where they also were annealing, but that was in the 60s. It's by Grossenobis and collaborators, and so we don't know if this change in the cutoff that they saw after annealing has anything to do with the change in the hysteresis loop. So at this point, we haven't seen a systematic study of the Barkhausen noise as a function of the disorder in the system.
Why do those experiments have anything to do with noise?
Okay, so if you would wrap a search coil around your sample in these experiments and then hook it up to a loudspeaker, you would get Barkhausen noise, basically because you would have... Oh, I'm sorry. Thanks for asking. Yeah, actually. Okay. No, I didn't. On this axis is magnetization. That's and yes, exactly. And on this axis is magnetic field. Yeah, I'm.
Isn't this exactly what you qualitatively? Isn't this the same as what you would get out of the Landau equation for a first order transition with the, in the presence of a field?
Okay.
If you tune the field, you know, small field at the bottom, big field at the top.
Yes, exactly. In fact, I'll come to that. Just give me a couple. In a sense, you can. This is sort of. You're right. I mean, here is a sort of a first order transition from. In equilibrium, you would have a first order transition from this to this. But now we're out of equilibrium, and now we have a second order transition as a function of disorder buried in this first order jump, so to speak. So I'm saying forget everything you know about equilibrium physics here. We're saying we're far from equilibrium. That's why we see hysteresis. And now we're tuning the disorder in the system. And as a result, we get a second order phase transition from hysteresis loops with a jump to those without a jump. Yeah. Yep.
Could you make a speculation, which you would not measure it, but I just want to extend the speculation. Where do you think there would be the most Barkhausen loops on the right-hand side?
Okay, I'm saying that in this loop probably would have Barkhausen jumps of all sizes.
Uh-huh. It would have the broadest band.
The broadest, exactly, the broadest range. That's exactly right. Because I would say this is near the phase transition where you have a divergent correlation
length. There would be Barkhausen noise in all cases.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. Except that the jump sizes here, say for this loop, would be very small. Because you're far away from the critical point. Yeah. Yeah. So I think this will become clearer when I show you what the model is and then connect back to experiment. So for our model, we use the zero temperature random field Ising model. So far from equilibrium. There has been lots of studies on this model in equilibrium, and I'm saying forget everything you know about this, because we're studying this model far from equilibrium, and to begin with at zero temperature. The reason we do zero temperature as a start is because we're interested in systems that are designed not to equilibrate at room temperature, like your magnetic tapes. I mean, they are definitely have large barriers to equilibration by design. So in the first step, we neglect that, and if you're interested in effects of temperature, I can say some more about this. Robert White has been doing some studies on that. But so we have here, this is the Hamiltonian. So you're saying basically you model your magnetic system as a crystal of spin that can only be up or down. And I'm saying, by the way, this doesn't just have to be you don't just have to think of magnets. I mean, this could be, you know, another system with crackling noise where you have these degrees of freedom that take two states at each side of the lattice. And then we say, well, spins like to be aligned, so you have a nearest neighbor ferromagnetic interaction, that's this term. Then we have an external driving field, that's a magnetic field that we use to drive through the hysteresis loop. And then we take into account the disorder. So we're saying at each point in the system, we have a random magnetic field that is quenched. That means it's fixed for all times. It doesn't change. And then we say, well, let's start with an infinitely negative magnetic field. So all the spins are pointing down because the external field forces them all down. And then we slowly raise the field. And we say each spin flips when its local field, which is the interaction with the neighbors, plus the random field, plus the external magnetic field, when that goes from down to up. So it's basically the simplest dynamics you could imagine. Each spin just follows its local field. So you can imagine, if there is a spin here that flips up, then due to the ferromagnetic interaction here, it can trigger neighboring spins to flip as well. So you one spin flips and it kicks the neighbors over, and they kick their neighbors and so on. So you get a cascade or an avalanche of spin flips. And
this case that you do it time dependent, which is method you do it the Laplace method or do something like Monte Carlo.
Okay, actually
the limit of zero temperature.
Well yeah, actually right now no temperature at all. So right now the rule
limit of zero temperature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Still it's like Monte Carlo, just that you have zero and one. Because you are in the limit of zero
temperature. Yeah, you could think of it that way. That's correct.
But still, that's wouldn't it matter if you have time dependent field that if you do it the order that you check it flip or not?
It's a good question. Actually for this model you can show it doesn't. It will matter if you allow random bonds, and in fact if you also allow some negative bonds.
Very local interaction. If you have next nearest neighbor.
Once you do long range, and especially once you have frustration in the system, I guess that's the key. If you get some anti-ferromagnetic bonds, then it starts to matter. Yes, absolutely.
What is it that's mattering?
So he's asking whether the order in which you flip the spins leads to different result. And I'm saying if you have frustration, yes. But in this case, you don't. So it's all ferromagnetic. So in this case, you can show it doesn't. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for asking. I wanted to point that out. We choose a Gaussian distribution of random fields of width R. So this is actually, I'm just emphasizing this because later I'm saying we tune the disorder. And what I mean with that is we tune this width R of the Gaussian distribution of random fields. Okay, I can tell you that in mean field theory you can calculate it exactly, but I can show you, I guess not. it turns out the important variable actually that you tune is the ratio of R to the nearest neighbor coupling, so that ratio is important. And then say, if you study this system even without the disorder, if you set R to zero, okay, let's say completely pure system, then even then you get a hysteresis loop with a finite width. Because you're saying all the spins stay down until your external field overcomes the interaction with the neighbors. So in that case, you get a hysteresis loop that's basically like a square. Is a function of J, exactly. And that's right. And so then when you switch on the disorder, basically what it does is it rounds out the corners of your... and basically what happens as you now increase the disorder, if you're interested in the coercive field, it shrinks, it gets more narrow. But actually this coercive field is non-universal. So we think in comparison to experiments, we never focus so much on the value of the coercive field because it's like TC or something. Yeah. Okay. So now if you now model the system with this simple dynamics, local dynamics, here's the model one more time. It's basically the same information. I just want to show you here, as you sweep, now notice, on this axis now is magnetization, and on this axis is magnetic field. So as you sweep up the field, and you sweep it back down, you indeed get hysteresis. And maybe just as an aside, let me mention, if you would sweep up, and you would back off at this point, and then you would sweep forward again, then at this point here, your system actually remembers the microstate. So actually, if you go through a little subloop and you go back up to this point B, every spin will be in exactly the same position it was when you first came to this point. And this is called return point memory, and we have a little proof basically for that it follows from three sufficient conditions. Basically, one of the main ones is that you have no frustration in your system. So if you would put in some negative bonds or something, that wouldn't be exact anymore. But in this case, because the system has no frustration, because you sweep, you have adiabaticity, and then this no frustration basically means that you have this no passing rule that Al Middleton had is fulfilled. So basically, no frustration leads to this return point memory in the system. And this has been seen in a lot of experimental systems, not all of them, but a lot of them. And now, just one more comment. If you simulate it, you might say, oh, well, this hysteresis loop looks smooth. But if you actually look closely, indeed, you will find in this magnetization loop F curve, you will find little steps. And these steps are these avalanches I talked about. So at fixed field, you still have a change in magnetization due to an avalanche. And these avalanches are the equivalent of that Barkhausen noise that people measure in experiments. One more thing I should say is, as we sweep through the loop, we assume that we're going slowly. So to begin with, you might look at the adiabatic case, where you sweep so slowly that when you trigger an avalanche, you first wait for the avalanche to finish before you then increase the field further. And my student, Robert White, did some very nice studies for what happens when you sweep faster than that. But right now, I'll just look at the adiabatic case. I'm sorry? Yes. Or if they reproduce? Yes, exactly. In fact, that is how in experiments people found that this is more than just remembering the magnetization. They went around the subloop and they went again and they found pretty much exactly the same noise. And so you have so you have like a fingerprint for this subloop telling you that you have the same sequence of avalanches every time you go around. And that's true in the model too. Yes, it's absolutely deterministic. That's right. Yeah, they looked at acoustic. This experiment I'm thinking of was in Martin sites. They looked at acoustic emission as they went through such a subloop. And then, in fact, I can show you. I think I have it with me. In fact, yeah, if you're interested, I can just show you how good it actually works. Yes. Well. True. Yeah, so here this is the experimental data from this Martin site experiment in Martin sites, where they go around the loop once, and this is the signal for the actually these were heat pulses, I think, that they measured, and then they went around and then they got this signal, and so it looks very similar. But I'm saying this is, I mean, there are other systems that don't do this. I mean, this is, yeah.
How do the power spectra of those two compare as well? Is it just not beyond just the superficial?
No, I imagine, I have not seen the power spectra for this specific noise, but I would imagine should be the same. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh, right. If it's really the same noise, it should be the same. Yeah. Okay. And if you're interested at the end, I mean, I can show you in the model where it follows from. I mean, you can formulate a condition when you get this, but it's seen in experiments as well. So now I just want to briefly show you what the model does. Actually, this is more, yeah, just as a motivation, and then I want to, yeah, okay. So we simulate this model at different disorders. Now, remember, the disorder was the width in this Gaussian distribution of random fields. And this is showing you, again, magnetization on the x-axis, field on the other axis, and this is showing you half of the hysteresis loop, so the other half would be down here. And it's showing you the hysteresis loop for different disorders. So over here is, again, something like this phase diagram we had earlier. This axis is disorder, this width of the Gaussian. This axis is magnetic field. So if you sweep the field at low disorder, then you eventually hit a point where you have an onset of a jump in your loop. And this jump is really due to an avalanche that sweeps through the entire system for the pure system. While if you sweep the field at high disorder, you get a very smooth loop. And then in between these two regimes, there is this critical disorder, which is sort of this critical curve, where you can't quite decide which regime you're in. And then that's your critical hysteresis loop. And then you can show from the numerics, and we also have done a randomization group calculation, that the size of this jump goes to zero at this critical point with some exponent beta, which is a universal exponent. And but rather than focusing on the magnetization curves too much, I want to point out the avalanches. So this is an avalanche size distribution. On this axis is avalanche size. This axis is how often you get an avalanche of that size. So it's like a histogram of the avalanches. And these are histograms for your hysteresis loops at different disorders. So at high disorder, you have a parallel with the cutoff. High, notice, the critical disorder is 2.16. So this is way above the critical disorder. So this would be the histogram of the jump sizes in a loop that is totally smooth. So at high disorder, you have mostly small jumps. And then as you decrease the disorder to get closer and closer towards the critical value, you see that the correlation length grows and you approach a parallel distribution of avalanche sizes, just like you expect near a second order phase transition. Now, there are these very nice methods, these Widom scaling methods. Basically, what you do is you rescale these axes in such a way that all these curves here collapse onto one curve. And this entire curve here is a universal prediction for experiment. This should not depend on the microscopic details. And by the amount you have to rescale these axes, you can read off what the corresponding critical exponents will be that you will have in the system. So you can, instead of just fitting a power law to this, which actually would give you a wrong answer, because unless you have you really have lots of decades, the scaling function sort of makes your distribution deviate from the correct extrapolated power law. So it's better to get your critical exponents from this scaling collapse method. And when you do that, you get all these universal predictions for experiments. Okay. So basically, what I've done is I've made actually here I've made a scaling ansatz. So I've said I assume that
S times odds.
Yes.
Power times S times. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So on this axis here, I'm assuming that this average distribution goes like 1 over S to the top plus sigma beta delta times some scaling function of S to the sigma minus R, where R is the reduced disorder, which is R minus RC.
If you look at the average avalanche size and the typical avalanche size,
So the average avalanche size diverges at the critical point but with a different power law than the maximum avalanche size the maximum gives you, so you have a correlation length basically that determines all these different quantities. So we have looked at the first moment of this avalanche size distribution and then the second moment and so on, and I can tell you the average avalanche size actually diverges exactly in the same way as your slope. It scales in the same way as the slope in the magnetization. And the typical, I'll have to think about exactly how it diverges. But you can, they're all related to each other. Yeah. So.
They diverge together.
Yes. I'm sorry?
Diverge
at the critical disorder. Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Yep. So now, one more thing that I want you to notice about this is that the critical region is huge. So you notice here, if you go 50% away from the critical disorder, you still have about two decades of scaling. So we think that in a lot of these systems, your critical region is large. So it might be that in these experiments, you just happen to fall into this huge critical region, and that's why you see power law scaling. Now you might ask, why is it so large? And there's one trivial reason. It's just that in experiments, often you plot avalanches. They're given in terms of volume. So one decade of scaling in terms of length translates into three decades of scaling in terms of volume. So that automatically makes it appear as a large region. But it's remarkable. So this is not like in thermal critical phenomena where you go like 2% away from TC and you lose effect. Here you have a very large critical region. Okay. So now you might say, well, the collapse works for the numerics. If you really want to understand this critical point, you need to do a renormalization group calculation, but I'll spare you that. I'm just telling you, we did that where you can actually see, as you coarse grain your system, you actually find a fixed point under the coarse graining transformation where you get power law scaling. And,
6 minus
epsilon. Mm-hmm. We did a 6 minus epsilon expansion. So 6 is the upper critical dimension.
Did you get singular correction exponents?
We had nothing. It was actually the 6 minus epsilon expansion. If you want to know what it looks like, actually it maps to all orders in epsilon onto the 6 minus epsilon expansion of the thermal random field Ising model.
Singular correction exponents there?
So, no.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean...
Because that might explain why the critical region is so large. If the correction exponents are big, if there aren't small singular, we can talk about
that. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you could look at the irrelevant, first leading irrelevant operator. Actually, that we haven't done. So I don't know that. Yeah, about that we haven't done it, but we could have. Yeah, but I think this argument with the volume already.
That's most of it.
Yeah, I think that already would explain most of it. Okay, so So what I really want to do is look at the exponents here. So here I'm on this axis. I'm plotting. These are the exponents that we get from the simulation and from experiments. So the question now is, how good is the model? And so here are the exponents plotted in a range from 1 to 3 here for the exponents. And then here are different exponents. They're not all independent, but those are just exponents that were quoted in the literature of Barkhausen-Noise experiments for the size distribution, duration distribution, and then different other quantities. And here you see the gray symbols are from different experiments in different materials. And the red dots are our model predictions. And then you see in all these different exponents, we fall pretty much within the pretty large range, in the range of experiments quoted in the literature, which really actually isn't that large if you notice that the scale just goes from 1 to 3 here, more or less. Exactly. So when we were thrilled about this, but then you look at mean field theory and then you say, well, it just does pretty much as good a job. And then there are other models like the front propagation model. You can think of Barkhausen noise. This is a different in soft magnets. Actually, your avalanches are mostly due to jumps of a pre-existing interface. So you could. Right, but absolutely, you can distinguish between them, but you cannot use the experiments to tell which one works better.
That was the
Actually, that leads to my next point. So this front propagation model, which is this, is like an interface depending model, also falls within this range more or less. So basically, the point I want to make is that exponents are not good enough to rule models out in these experimental data results that we have so far. So on the one hand, of course, it's nice to have more experiments. On the other hand, there are other predictions that we can extract from the model that give you more information than just the exponents. And those are scaling functions. So I mentioned one scaling function earlier. I said, well, if you collapse all these curves here onto one, this entire function is universal. The problem is experiments, so far there is no experiment on Barkhausen noise or any other avalanche system that we know of where people systematically could vary the disorder and then measure the noise as a function of disorder. And that's what you need in order to extract the scaling function. So that function we cannot compare to experiments. But there is a different scaling function that you can extract from experiments. And that is if you look at that is sort of the mean avalanche profile. So you can ask yourself, if I take a single avalanche, so in the magnets it would be measuring voltage as a function of time, a single avalanche would look something like this. And this here is the total duration of the avalanche. If you now say I take all avalanches of the same duration and average them, then you would expect to see some mean profile. In fact, it looks sort of like this. Now, if your system is at the critical point, you would say, well, I have sort of self-similar behavior on all length scales, so you would expect that this mean profile for avalanches of a longer duration, you know, like probably is just a rescaled version of the mean profile at smaller durations, because your system looks the same on all length and time scales up to a rescaling. So we did this. We took actually, Amit Mehta, he took like a lot of avalanches at different durations and collapsed them all onto one mean profile by rescaling the two axes. So this is universal scaling function for the random field Ising model, the model that we talked about. And then you can also do that for the interface model, and it looks very similar. But it's not the same. You can actually, Amit fitted a set of orthonormal functions.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Or something like that.
No, that's just a regular front propagation. So yeah, uh-huh. And they actually are different. So he did a very.
And what about these exponents?
Yeah.
Do you adjust these exponents, or do you take them from somewhere else?
Yeah. So he used the exponents that. He did both. He used the one that we got from the other collapses, and then he also did a collapse just varying this, and both agreed. So he, in the exponents, he got the same. Yeah.
How much do you vary one from the other? If you look at the different avalanches of the same week.
Yes.
Because you show us the average in August.
True.
If you look at the variations in them of the correlation, just the different one.
Sure.
Would there be a difference between the two models, not in the mean, but in the variation?
Well, the width of the variation would scale with the duration with a certain exponent, and I can tell you, I can derive what that exponent would be. And that exponent is will be a function of the sigma nu z, and those two are slightly different, but numerically with overlapping error bars in the two models. So I think in these two models, you may not be able to see much difference. That's what I would think. We haven't actually numerically extracted that quantity, though. But I know you can write down a probability function for the voltage. You know, what's the probability to get a voltage of a certain size in an avalanche of a given size? And from that function, you can extract, the width of the distribution of your voltages.
Yeah, but that's again an average quantity. I'm talking about different things. I'm talking about not statistical average quantities, but variation in different realizations.
Yes, okay.
Simulations, for example.
So like
look at different avalanches.
Right, uh-huh. Yes.
How much would they be different one from the other?
Yes, I know, I realize. But, and I'm saying it will scale with your, you can derive a scaling form for it, like say, the standard deviation of the voltages distribution. Instead of just looking at the mean, you can look at the standard deviation, you can look at the, you know, and all these different quantities, and you can derive, I can tell you whether it's, I mean, not offhand, but I can show you which distribution to look for. Is that what you're asking? No.
Okay, we'll talk about
okay.
that.
Okay.
Because you mentioned all the functions or the different observed quantities that are actually generated by the same scaling function. I'm talking about looking for different observables that might not be generated by this. And then you might see differences between the two different models or between the model and the experiment.
Okay, well, actually, you may not even have to go that far, because I can, first of all, I can tell you there is a difference between these two models here in the function. I mean, for you, it looks the same, but Amit did a very careful job fitting a set of orthonormal functions to this universal scaling function, and he found these two are definitely different. So, I mean, bigger than the arrow bars of the numerics. So the scaling functions of these two models are different. But to answer your question about the experiment, if you now look at the experiment, it's definitely different. I mean, you can notice it. This is this universal scaling function extracted from experimental avalanches, just the same way as I did in the theory. Now, maybe don't. I'm not so sure about this black one here. There are some questions about that one. But these two experiments, especially three. This third experiment, this one should be in the same universality class as the interface propagation model. And the exponents agree pretty well with that model, but the scaling function does not. So neither of our models, or neither of the models I showed you, agrees with the experimental scaling function. The experimental scaling function has this asymmetry to the left. The avalanches start fast and decay slowly. And we, at this point, we do not know why that is. We're trying different things. What could be the problem? We just don't know. So that's an open question. So the exponents agree. The scaling function does not agree. That's right now where we're looking into reasons for that. Now, I didn't want to show this, but I'll just show it since there came some questions. So the universality class of this model I showed you should be huge. If you would have made the interactions random with a mean greater than zero, or if you would have chosen a different source of disorder instead of random fields, you would have used random anisotropies and so on. That should all be in the same universality class. You can change the universality class by changing the dynamics. So I mentioned the interface model. That's a model where you only allow spins to flip at an interface. And Mark Robbins and Stefano Zapperi and other people have done very careful study of this model. So that is in a different universality class. Or if you add long-range forces to the model, that changes the universality class too.
So on what basis did you make the first statement that they all
belong to the universality class? Okay.
Calculation, or is it obvious?
On the one hand, there is sort of a fast argument that just goes by symmetries. So you know that you can show from the randomization group follows, as long as you have the same symmetries, dimensions, and you know these basic properties are the same, you are in the same universality class. Now you might think, well, if I choose, for example, random anisotropies, you might think, oh well, you know, now I allow the spins to point in all directions, no longer in a certain preferred direction. So don't I have somehow more symmetry in the system? And the answer is no, you don't, because your external field already breaks the symmetry. You know, you measure all this power law scaling comes from avalanches that happen at a non-zero field. So your applied field already breaks this additional symmetry that you have in a in a system with random anisotropies. Or the same thing is true when you have random bonds instead of random fields. You might think, well, what about time reversal symmetry? You know, it's not broken if you have random bonds. But then again, your external field breaks that. So it's different from the equilibrium models where you are at zero field typically, and then you have actually new symmetries in these models, but here you don't. So that's sort of the hand-waving argument. But then you can also, for example, for there has been a calculation by, I just can't think of the name right now, Rava Silveira and Carter, Maron Carter, they looked at ON models. So they allowed the spin to have n components. Actually did the calculation, they actually do find the same exponent. So there is a detailed randomization calculation that shows that's true in that case. But actually I did also a calculation for the random bond case explicitly where you see it follows from the RG. But the symmetry argument is maybe the, you know, it already captures that. Yep? So as actually when I say random bonds, I mean it's important that you choose your mean to be positive. If you choose the mean to be zero or negative, then you absolutely, something different happens. But if you choose the mean to be positive, then you only, at most, you have like little tails of negative bonds and they don't change the universal behavior. Yeah. Uh-huh. I was going to tell you, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to mention this, and then if you're interested, you can ask me later. John Carpenter now did a study of subloops. You know, this model you can also use to study subloops, and he found that if you study the subloops of this model at the critical disorder, then you can use history as a tuning parameter. You see, as you go inside your loop, you go to smoother loops. So that means, history inside the loop is sort of equivalent to higher disorder. So this loop sort of looks like a saturation loop we had earlier at higher disorder. And he took that literal and studied whether you can use history as a tuning parameter, and the answer is yes. And so he extracted universal exponents for the subloops. And then you can also look at demagnetization curves. So you can ask yourself, if you link up the reversal points of all these subloops, then you get a so-called demagnetization curve. And then you can study that demagnetization curve as a function of disorder. And that's interesting because people thought that demagnetization curves tend to be close to the equilibrium. The demagnetized state tends to be close to the equilibrium state. So he extracted universal exponents for that, and they actually look very similar to the equilibrium ones, but that doesn't mean that the states are the same, of course. And then I mentioned before that Robert White studied what happens as you go at a finite sweep rate. And he found that under certain conditions you can get exponents that depend linearly on the sweep rate. I can tell you more about that. But so to summarize, what I did so far is showed you that the shape of the hysteresis loops changes from jumps with loops with a jump to those without a jump. And there was this critical point, and we got all these exponents, and there is a big need for experiments to test a lot of these ideas, especially experiments that are able to tune the disorder. So now I gave a talk on that, and I showed how these avalanche size distributions change with the disorder in this model. And Yehuda Ben Zion, he was in the audience, and afterwards he came to me and he said, "This looks just like earthquakes." And then he showed me this data. So you can ask, if you look at the statistics of earthquakes, so far, people knew for a long time that if you look at the statistics of earthquakes for the entire world, you know, make a histogram of earthquake magnitudes. This is like the magnitude you hear in the news, Gutenberg Richter, and this is how often you get an earthquake of that size. So So when you look at this histogram of that distribution, you find a power law distribution over many decades. That has been known for a long time. But recently, people have been able to actually get enough data for individual faults, instead of lumping them all together, and get statistics just for a single fault. And they found some faults give you Gutenberg-Richter-like magnitude distributions for the earthquakes, while other faults give you this distribution with a bump. These are called characteristic earthquake distributions. Those are the faults like the San Andreas fault, where every 50 years or so you get a large earthquake, and in between you have smaller ones. So there is this gap in the distribution here, and this over-representation of
What you present here is the magnitude of the earthquake, right?
A histogram of the magnitude. So that's sort of the analog. Correct.
The data also on the histogram of the distances, time interval between earthquakes, say, of a given magnitude?
Yes. Yes.
And how does it distribute?
Okay, so in this case, these large earthquakes, the largest ones, they recur quasi-periodically. So there seems to be like fairly regular time interval between these large ones. While in these cases, it's pretty random. So there's no quasi-periodicity between the largest ones. You know, it's just like Poisson or something. I don't know. I have only seen very, very rough histograms. So actually from that, I could not even give you a precise answer from the observations. Yeah. But I know that. What was remarkable was that in these systems you do have this quasi-periodicity for the large ones. So that was notably above the rest. While here you didn't have such a feature. But I haven't seen a very precise observational study.
They tried to do additional thing. Each earthquake has the characteristic figure in terms of the type of frequency and type of the.
Yep. The seismic emission. Yep.
Do you know if they did correlation between different events of earthquake?
Well, I know that there are certain faults where they have these so-called hotspots, where they get almost like the same event recurring again and again and again, and looks like the seismic emission looks pretty much the same, but that seems to be special cases. So that's like certain faults, and I'm not exactly sure if it's understood what's happening there. But it doesn't seem to be the, you know, like they told me about special faults like that one or that one. You know, it's not like you find it in every fault. Yeah. But that's a. In fact, it seems like there's a lot of open questions in this earthquake study field that you can approach as a physicist with some of these methods. Oh, and I forgot to say one thing. So the main thing I wanted to, I'm running out of time here. What I wanted to point out about this is that those faults that give you this Gutenberg-Richter distribution are faults that, when you look at the structure, the geometrical structure of the fault, it's very disordered. While those faults that give you this behavior, those are the smooth faults. They have been smoothed out over lots of years. So they don't have as many offsets as these faults. So there seems to be a correlation between the shape of the fault and the statistics of earthquakes. And this looks just like in the magnets, where the pure magnets where gave you these large events that would give you a distribution of avalanche sizes like this, while the disordered ones, more disordered ones, would give you a distribution that looks more like this. Now, we did actually a detailed study on this. So we used a model that people had introduced in earthquakes, where you actually map your fault onto a two-dimensional plane, and then you take these disorder in the fault structure into account as disorder in the brittle properties of the fault. And I don't think I have time to go into the details of the model, but basically it emerges that you can, as you tune the disorder in your fault, actually, to be honest, it's really something like introducing dynamic versus static friction. You can see these different statistics that they find in the observation. So we think it's true that there's a correlation between the disorder And I mean, the model can mimic a correlation between the disorder and the statistics of the earthquakes. Now, what I really wanted to show you was, you know, now how can you use what we learned from the magnets and apply it to data analysis in the earthquakes? So we said the problem is the error bars in any parallel distributions for the earthquakes are huge because the statistics are not very good. So it would in the earthquake be particularly nice if you had a universal function rather than just exponents. And so from the magnets we learned that this mean profile of your earthquakes was universal. So now that we had a model that produced exponents that fit into the range that you get in experiments and even can produce these different statistics, we computed, you know, for earthquakes you can look at the moment rate, that's the amount of slip per time during an earthquake, and just like we did for the magnets, you can average over lots of earthquakes at the same time, you get a mean profile, and the model predicts basically a parabola. Mean field theory actually is exact in this case. Because for that model, mean field theory, the upper critical dimension is a physical dimension. So now you can compare this mean shape to earthquakes to a fault that is sort of at the critical point and do the same thing for data. And so that's what we did. We got data from different earthquakes of different durations averaged. And these are different average profiles for different times. And now if you rescale this with the exponents, the correct exponents, just like we did in the magnet case, then, I want you to focus on the top one. Then this is the picture you get. This is the theoretical prediction, and this is the collapsed data from earthquakes of different durations. Now, of course, with huge error bars. But notice, again, we think you can see a systematic shift of the observational data to the left while the theory doesn't have that. And again, we don't know why that is.
What did the Gutenberg-Richter law look like for that fault?
Yeah, here.
Is that one without the bump?
Actually, yes, it is. So it's at the
one without the bump meant that it was close to the critical point.
Exactly.
And
That's right. In fact, to be really honest, this is not even data from a single fault. This is data from lots of faults lumped together. So this is like
that don't have these bumps and that are supposed to be near critical.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And so. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Let's randomize it earlier.
Yep.
So each earthquake has its own characteristic shape, you can call it monitor. Okay?
So this thing.
Okay. Now you average them all together.
Yep.
I was asking before what I referred to. If you do the correlations between them, it might be that you have, say, two groups of characteristic type of earthquake of this size. Then if you average them separately, each one will fit your universal curve. But if you average together, then you get something which is shifted the way that you show in the next transparency.
Oh, you're saying some that sort of...
It might be that they are divided into, for example, two kind or three kind.
Oh, okay.
They look more similar, but you average over these two, three, whatever number of
people. That's what their model says.
Yeah, or that's right.
In the model.
Yeah, that's right. In the model, there wouldn't be any split up. But you're
not.
Yeah.
If you compare to the experiment and you see the deviation between the experiment and the model, it might be that the model hints to you that look at the experiment, look at this structure factor. Typical shape and try to do correlation between all these events of earthquake that you saw. Then you see that you have two groups. Then if you average one of them together and the other one, they will give you things that agree to the experiment. But if you average them together, then you see a large difference from the from the model.
Yeah. I mean, in the sense, you're right. We should study more about this, not just the mean, but other things too, and to see. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's true. That's a good idea. We could do that. Yeah. So to summarize, I'll stop here. To summarize, what I've tried to do is show you two systems where this order played a role. They were dynamical systems, and where in both cases we could apply the same methods, and we got the same problem at the end. I didn't get to say anything about the bacteria, but the connection of thought in the bacteria is, and Nadav Schnerb will tell you a lot more about that, is if you have bacteria in a, you can have, look at colonies of bacteria in random media. And so there are these, you can look at a growing front in a system where quench disorder plays a role. And then you can ask the same kinds of questions, you know, how does this front of a growing colony propagate in the case that you have quench disorder due to nutrient concentration fluctuations? And that would be very much very similar questions here to the question of a magnetic domain wall, say, propagating through a disordered media. But I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much for your attention. Yep. The observations, right? Yep.
So it seems to be like just a very superficial level of looking from here and looking at it.
Yeah.
Does your model have the bump too?
Yes, we can produce the bump. In fact, we have a tuning parameter in the model. The model really, if you study it in the quasi-static case, basically what we're saying is really simple. We're saying at each point you have these cells and you say they fail at a certain failure threshold. And then they slip until the stress on that cell gets reduced to some arrest stress, and then the threshold failure varies from point to point in the lattice, and so
in a quenched way
exactly. And so now if you drive the system, then it's exactly the same thing as interface propagation at the depinning point, actually, because the way you drive it from far away, and it's like driving it with a weak spring, and you end up sitting at the depinning point, and you are exactly in the same universality class. That's in the quasi-static case, you get Gutenberg-Richter behavior, just a power law. But then if you say, well, now let's introduce weakening, sort of like a dynamic friction type of thing. So you're saying after a cell fails, you reduce the threshold by an amount to a smaller value, and it stays that small until the earthquake finishes. And in that case, you develop a bump at the end of the distribution. And if you want to understand that in terms of your depinning transition, then basically the Gutenberg-Richter corresponds to sitting right at the depinning point of the model, while if you introduce this weakening, then that introduces hysteresis in your depinning. So this is the velocity, the interface velocity as a function of driving force. And so basically what it's doing, you load your fault more and more by increasing the force on it by from far away, and then finally your rupture starts, and then your system slips, so you have one fault, one side moving against the other until the effective force on the fault gets reduced down to some lower value. And so basically the avalanches in here correspond to the small avalanches, and then this bump corresponds to this huge event that releases the stress. But basically, we have a tuning parameter. I'm saying that's this weakening in the threshold that brings you from this to this. Yeah.
So that's the control parameter.
Yes. Correct.
It's not a tuning, it's the control parameter. I mean, you can tune it because you don't know where each fault is, and so in terms of what its control parameter.
Yeah, but that's...
That is the control parameter.
Yes, exactly right. Yes. And so then you might argue that in very smooth faults, you know, this dynamic friction is more important than in very disordered faults. That's why I was saying, effectively, in highly disordered faults, you get this behavior, and in very smooth faults, you get this behavior in the model too, if you say that this parameter sort of is an effective measure of your structure. Yeah. Yeah.
the large universality size, and you're saying initially it was by symmetry when you've done RG calculations. Have there been functional RG calculations dealing with that problem as well then or no?
Well, yes. I mean, that's sort of what we did is we used the Martin Sidra Rose formalism. So basically what we do is we put these spins in a double well potential and make them soft spins, and then we write down an equation of motion for each spin, and then as we set, drive the system, you know, it basically becomes a dynamical problem, you know, for the entire system. So the Martin Sidra Rose is convenient because it allows you to average over the disorder right away, and then you just treat it as a dynamical disordered system. And it turns out it's actually very similar to some renormalization group calculations people have done for the depinning transition in magnets or for charge density waves, like Anatom Narayan and Daniel Fisher did this. That's actually where I learned all these methods. But it turns out to be much simpler. They have entire functions that become relevant at the upper critical dimension. We don't. For us, it just looks like, you know, there's just one term that becomes relevant below six dimension. So it's more like the typical Ising system. So it's much simpler.